Chapter 10. A Greek Tragedy. Slowly the poison the whole bloodstream fills. It is not the effort, nor the failure, tires. The waste remains. The waste remains and kills. Sir William Empson. Ptolemy III's successor was not the new Ramesses his father had hoped for. By the time he came to the throne at about 20 years old in 222 BC, it was clear that he had neither the military genius of a Macedonian king, nor the mental sophistication of an Egyptian pharaoh. This alone was no reason to fear for Egypt's future. The new pharaoh had inherited a stable administration and stable borders. Provided he could maintain this balance, the Egyptians' beloved Maat, and avoid external trouble, there was reason to think that Ptolemaic rule would continue at least to appear glorious. But what made Ptolemy IV's succession different was not the usual threats and manoeuvres from abroad, but something much closer to home. When the young pharaoh took the Egyptian throne, he was not alone. Standing in the shadows was another man, a man who was not simply the king's adviser, but his puppeteer. The man in the shadows was a court official called Sosibius, and the classical historian Polybius is quite blunt about his role in what was about to unfold. Sosibius appears to have been a dexterous instrument of evil, who remained long in power and did much mischief in the kingdom. The problem had begun long before Ptolemy IV took the throne, when it became clear that he would rely on favourites for everything, being unable or unwilling to take any role in the running of his household or the state himself. Many previous pharaohs had, of course, relied upon court officials to administer the country on their behalf, but all had at least the knowledge and instincts to choose their proxies well. Ptolemy IV was inexperienced, lazy, and a very poor judge of character, and the result was that on his taking the throne, Sosibius became Egypt's first minister. Ptolemy, convinced that the running of the state was now in hand, then retired to indulge in the lavish festivities of the court and the pleasures of the royal bedchamber. Sosibius kept a tight exclusion zone around the pharaoh, ensuring that all the information he got from the outside world came through him. In doing so, he carefully created an atmosphere of suspicion and fear, in which those who threatened him or his control over the pharaoh could be denounced and neutralized in a moment. The cull had begun, as in so many previous Ptolemaic reigns, with the death of the new king's immediate family, those best placed to challenge his rule. Within months of his accession, his uncle, his father's brother, was dead. Then his younger brother was accidentally scalded to death with boiling water while taking a bath, and finally his mother perished, most probably poisoned. Sosibius had a hand in all these killings, and the move served him well. Not only could he claim to have removed those who might envy the king his throne, he had in the process left Ptolemy alone, without friends or family for support or advice. Ptolemy was now entirely under Sosibius's spell. "The murdered is well disposed," became a saying in Alexandria at the time. While stripping away Ptolemy's support, Sosibius was also careful to build his own. Aiding and abetting him was a courtier called Agathocles, who was probably a boyhood friend of the young king's and who cemented his hold on the king by way of his sister, Agathoclea, who became the royal mistress. Hearing only the whispers of his ministers and mistress, Ptolemy began his reign confident of his own security. He flattered himself that his summary action against his relatives had secured his throne, while news from the Near East that two of his main foreign enemies, Antigonus and Seleucus, had died, leaving children on their thrones, further boosted his sense of invulnerability. The result, as Polybius tells us, was predictable. Secure, therefore, in his present good fortune, he began to conduct himself as if his chief concern were the idle pomp of royalty, showing himself as regards the members of his court and the officials who administered Egypt inattentive to business and difficult of approach, and treating with entire negligence and indifference the agents charged with the conduct of affairs outside Egypt, to which the former kings had paid much more attention than to the government of Egypt itself. This new king, neglecting to control all these matters, owing to his shameful amours and senseless and constant drunkenness, found, as was to be expected, in a very short time both his life and his throne threatened by more than one conspiracy. Polybius, The Histories. The first signs of trouble seemed relatively unimportant. During the reign of Ptolemy III, an exiled Spartan king by the name of Cleomenes III had taken asylum in Alexandria, where he continued to make a nuisance of himself, constantly plaguing the new king with requests for a ship and a small army, so that he could retake his native land. But Ptolemy IV, who on his accession took the almost ironic name Philopator, he who loves his father, refused to assist. Cleomenes was not a man to be rebuffed, however, and he began attempting to recruit an army in the city himself. At this news, Sosibius panicked, suspecting that the Spartan king might turn the mercenaries currently employed by the Egyptian state against him, so he had Cleomenes imprisoned. In sheer desperation, when Philopator was visiting the delta town of Canopus, Cleomenes and his colleagues managed to escape, and running through the streets of Alexandria, tried to incite the mob to turn against the pharaoh. But despite their shouts that they had evidence that the king had murdered his mother, a very popular woman in the city, and despite the fact that the claim was probably true, the usually restive city mob failed to rise up. In despair, Cleomenes and his men took the Spartan way out of what was becoming an impossible situation and killed themselves with their own knives. The Spartan's wife and children, entrusted to the care of Ptolemy, fared equally poorly, and were soon put to death on Sosibius's orders. If Ptolemy and Sosibius had been wrong in thinking they could keep their private affairs from the Alexandrian public and men like Cleomenes, serious threat was now emerging in the form of the young Antiochus III, ruler of the Seleucid Empire. Unlike his counterpart in Alexandria, this young man kept himself fully informed of all the news from his rival kingdoms, and so soon realized that the young Ptolemy was both weak and ensnared by a corrupt and self-serving court. He wasted no time. Gathering a strong army, he invaded Syria, rolling up the Ptolemaic possessions in the Near East almost as far as Palestine, Egypt's front doorstep, before the Egyptian army could muster. In the blink of an eye, the conquests of Philopator's father were lost, and the way to Egypt looked open. Fortunately for Ptolemy Philopator, Antiochus's campaign encountered much stiffer resistance as it moved south toward Egypt proper, with several cities withstanding his sieges for months. As Antiochus's army got bogged down, Sosibius called for and got a ceasefire for 4 months. It was a desperate gamble, but it worked, buying time so that he and Agathocles could gather an army to resist the invasion of Egypt itself. In an attempt to fool Antiochus into believing he would sue for peace, Sosibius built up Egypt's army secretly at Alexandria. Negotiations for the ceasefire and all other diplomatic traffic were rerouted from the capital to Memphis during the winter of 219 to 218 BC as recruits from all over the Mediterranean were gathered, drilled, and formed into fighting units in Alexandria. Paying for this huge mercenary army naturally put a heavy burden on the Egyptian peasantry, but Sosibius planned to utilize his own population in another, entirely novel way. Whereas in the past, the Ptolemies had fought their wars with local and imported Macedonian and other foreign troops, this time Sosibius decided to recruit and train a local phalanx of Egyptian troops, armed and drilled in Macedonian style. The 20,000 Egyptians of the phalanx would be led personally by Sosibius and would play a decisive role in the forthcoming battle and beyond. At the end of the ceasefire in 218 BC, Antiochus resumed his conquest of southern Syria, but the revitalized Egyptians put up sufficient resistance to check him in the Bekaa Valley, in what is now Lebanon, and to hold on to Damascus and Sidon. This brought enough time for Sosibius to bring his new weapon into play. By the spring of 217 BC, the Ptolemaic secret army was ready, and was led to battle by Ptolemy IV. According to Polybius, the army included 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 African elephants. Against him, Antiochus fielded 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 Indian elephants. The two armies met outside the small town of Rafia, modern-day Rafah, near Gaza, setting up camp opposite each other where they sized each other up for 5 days. On the fifth day, June 22, 217 BC, Ptolemy moved his troops out of camp to take up battle positions, and Antiochus immediately followed suit. Both sides placed their strongest, hand-picked phalanxes in the center, with elephants and cavalry on each wing. Ptolemy, his sister, Arsinoe, and their retinue took a place on the left flank, opposite Antiochus and his horse guards on their extreme right. At the same moment, Ptolemy and Antiochus gave the signal for their elephants to charge, and the battle began. According to Polybius, Antiochus's Indian elephants outweighed and outfought the smaller African forest elephants of Ptolemy's army, and many of the latter turned and fled into their own ranks, breaking the line of Ptolemy's left wing and causing enormous confusion. Still, the forces facing each other on Ptolemy's right wing held back, waiting. Polybius tells us, "When he, Echecrates, Ptolemy's general, saw the cloud of dust being carried in his direction, and their own elephants not even daring to approach those of the enemy, he ordered Phocidas, with the mercenaries from Greece, to attack the hostile force in the front, while he himself with his cavalry and the division immediately behind the elephants moving off the field and round the enemy's flank, avoided the onset of the animals and speedily put to flight the cavalry of the enemy, charging them both in flank and rear. Phocidas and his men met with the same success, for charging the Arabs and Medes they forced them to headlong flight. Antiochus's right wing then was victorious, while his left wing was being worsted in the manner I have described. Meanwhile, the phalanxes, stripped of both their wings, remained intact in the middle of the plain, swayed alternately by hope and fear." Polybius, The Histories. An overconfident Antiochus now pressed home his advantage on the right wing, assuming that both the centre ground held by the phalanxes and the left wing were as victorious as he had been, and hence believing that the battle was as good as won. But at that moment, Ptolemy, who had taken shelter within his own phalanx, suddenly rode forward, urging his men on. This stunned the enemy and rallied Ptolemy's own troops in the centre. Lowering their sarissas, 18-foot-long double-pointed pikes, the phalanx under Ptolemy's general Andromachus and the Egyptian phalanx under Sosibius advanced together in full charge. The Syrians facing them resisted briefly, but soon crumbled under the overwhelming pressure and turned and fled. Antiochus, not yet the great general he would one day become, was forced to dash for cover behind the walls of Raphia and console himself with the solace of all bad workmen who blame their tools rather than themselves. He retired to Raphia in the confident belief that as far as it depended on himself he had won the battle, but had suffered this disaster owing to the base cowardice of the rest. Polybius reports that Antiochus left behind on the battlefield more than 10,000 infantry dead and 300 cavalry also killed, with a further 4,000 men taken prisoner. Ptolemy had lost about 1,500 foot and 700 horse, as well as 16 elephants dead and most of the rest captured. Ptolemy, so it seemed, was as victorious as his father had been. But this would be the last time Asia would see a pharaoh ride out to battle in person. The next few heady months were spent reoccupying Syria, after sending Sosibius to Antioch to negotiate punitive peace terms with Antiochus. In the meantime, the young Ptolemy occasionally laid siege to or sacked a town to keep up the pressure on the negotiations. Finally, on October the 12th, 217 BC, Philopator returned in triumph to Egypt, rewarding his victorious army with 300,000 pieces of gold and sending abundant gifts to the temples of Egypt to thank the gods for his great victory. On the face of it, he seemed to be repeating the pattern of all his ancestors, setting off while still young to score a resounding victory in Asia and re-establishing the Near Eastern buffer zone. Surely now he was entitled to the abundant leisure he so craved. Unfortunately for the Ptolemies, back in Alexandria, the perfect setting for his decadence had already been created, ironically enough, in the halls of the museum. The literary scene that would provide the backdrop to Philopator's disastrous reign had been created during his father's lifetime, and it had begun with a new emphasis in the institution on literature rather than science. Ptolemy III had given his most gifted scholar-writer, Callimachus of Cyrene, the immense task of cataloguing the ever-increasing mountain of books accruing in the library. This he began at the height of his powers around 250 BC, when he embarked on his Pinakes, literally, lists, whose full title translates as List of Those Who Distinguished Themselves in All Branches of Learning and Their Writings. As the full title suggests, this was no mere catalogue. Running to 120 separate books, it was a comprehensive survey of all the books held in the great library, along with biographical and bibliographical details of the authors. In short, a survey of all known classical literature up to the time of its compilation. In this work he also introduced the notion of a library classification system, the forerunner of our Dewey Decimal System, in which all books were classified as written by 1. Dramatists, 2. Epic and lyric poets, 3. Legislators, 4. Philosophers, 5. Historians, 6. Orators, 7. Rhetoricians, or 8. Miscellaneous writers. Not that this impressed everyone. One of the first new tomes Callimachus had to catalogue with his system was Aristophanes of Byzantium's highly critical Against Callimachus's Library Lists. History does not record which number he chose for it. Besides the mammoth task of the Pinakes, Callimachus also wrote his own poetry. His longest work, the Aetia, Causes, is a narrative elegy in 4 parts, one of which, The Lock of Berenice, records the story of the constellation Coma Berenice. This poem was freely copied by Catullus, and subsequently became the model for Alexander Pope's 1712 poem, The Rape of the Lock. Callimachus was above all a stylist, famed for his conciseness, precision, and artistry, a great master of the finely turned phrase, often in epigrammatic form. Even when he tackled enormous subjects like the Pinakes or Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, his method was to break up the longest works by having them copied into shorter sections. He is said to have maintained that all big books were boring books. For all his love of brevity, Callimachus was a prolific writer, credited with producing about 700 works in all, and he became hugely famous in his day and in the succeeding centuries. In fact, no other Greek poet except Homer is so often quoted by the grammarians of late antiquity. He was best known for his epigrams, of which 63 have survived. Epigram 31, an epitaph, displays his wit and elegance superbly. It takes the form of a dialogue. "Tell me, is Caridas buried here? If it's the son of Arimas you mean, he's here. Caridas, how is it down there? Darkness. What of return? A lie. And Pluto? A myth. We're done for, then. I've given you the truth. If you prefer pleasantry, beef's a penny a pound in Hades." Callimachus's insistence on brevity put him somewhat at odds with his most famous pupil, Apollonius of Rhodes, whose lifetime ambition had been to set down in verse the epic adventures of Jason and the Argonauts. But Apollonius's epic chimed with the times, an adventure tale of brave Greek warriors who journeyed, like Alexander, to the edges of the known world, visiting en route Cyrenaica, the Aegean Islands, and the Black Sea, all places of considerable interest to the Ptolemies and their trading, seafaring nation. The heroes are portrayed in overtly Homeric style, and the boat itself and accompanying technology are deliberately set in an archaic context. But Apollonius weaves into the text all sorts of modern scientific and geographical ideas and knowledge, along with a more traditional fabulous geography of clashing rocks, sirens, and mythical beasts. Into this admixture of modern science within the traditional setting, Apollonius introduces an innovation of his own, a running commentary on his own narrative, as Richard Hunter explains in the introduction to his 1993 translation of the Argonautica. A particular mode for the expression of this textual self-consciousness is irony and humour. Where the poet is constantly also a commentator on his poetry, the anticipation of reading and reception is inscribed in the text itself, and the poet becomes not just a creator, but also a reader, himself surprised by his own creation. When, for example, Medea puts the evil eye on Telos, Apollonius reacts as a particular type of reader of the Argonautica might react. "Father Zeus, my mind is all aflutter with amazement. If it is true that death comes to us not only from disease and wounds, but someone far off can harm us, as that man, bronze though he was, yielded to destruction through the grim powers of Medea, mistress of drugs." Apollonius, Jason and the Golden Fleece. The poet stands outside his poem and contemplates it, almost as though he had nothing to do with it. This dreamlike, wistful myth-making was now the setting for Ptolemy IV's return from the wars. The revival in heroic literature gave him the perfect foil for his own reign, the perfect opportunity to revel in his own position as a hero god to his people. But in this, as with so much, he was gravely mistaken. Taking the sister who had accompanied him to war as his wife, although still entirely under the sway of his mistress, Agatha Clear, he now lost himself in romantic reveries of heroic tales. The future seemed bright. His father had fought a great war at the beginning of his reign, and then retired, safe to live out his years among his scholars and courtiers. Why shouldn't the son do exactly the same? But Ptolemy was no returning Jason, and his Argonauts were no more than a gaggle of sycophants. Back at court, the king and his favourites became ever more detached from the reality of life in Egypt and the political situation outside. The young king duly set about building his own literary court, but even here something was clearly different from his father's day. In the place of the Aristarchus and Eratosthenes of previous years, the court now, according to an early 20th-century biographer of the Ptolemies, swarmed with literary pretenders, poets, grammarians, whores, buffoons, philosophers. It seems Ptolemy Philopater was not content simply to fund the museum. He intended to be its greatest star as well, and as such gathered around him a multitude of favourites to praise his own work. When he wrote his own terrible play, an erotic idyll called Adonis, the obsequious Agathocles immediately produced a laudatory commentary on it. One story from the time tells how the king arranged a poetry competition where the entries were judged on the amount of applause each rendition received. However, one judge, Aristophanes of Byzantium, chose the poem that received the least applause. When asked why, he went to the great library and produced texts that proved that only the poem he had chosen was actually original. All the others were simply copied from earlier works. Ptolemy's court had pretensions to be the museum, but in fact it was a mockery. But far more serious than the pharaoh's personal delusions was the situation in his country. The great victory Sosibius had orchestrated contained a poisonous seed. That seed lay in the heart of Sosibius's greatest achievement, among the native Egyptian troops he had raised and trained to fight for their pharaoh. They had seen the magnificence of the great Ptolemaic court. They had seen the plunder, and now they had returned to the reality of life in their country. Many of these highly trained warriors made their way back to the heartland of the ancient capital of Thebes, modern Luxor, only to find their families in extreme poverty and much of the land in disrepair. Native Egyptians had always known they were an underclass under Greek rule, but while the Ptolemies made Egypt great again, they had kept their silence. Now the administration was in the hands of corrupt favourites, taxes were exorbitant, and their sacrifice in the Middle East seemed to have benefited everyone except themselves. There was only one conclusion. Ptolemy the Fourth, Philopator, was not a god king, he was a foreign impostor. And when the situation in the countryside failed to improve, a full-scale rebellion broke out in Thebes in 206 BC against the false gods of the Alexandrians. This immediately struck chords with the Egyptian peasantry, who had been taxed to the breaking point to finance Ptolemy's war. In fact, many had fled to remote areas in the desert or in the marshy Nile Delta, where they had become outlaws, roaming the countryside and ravaging small villages and temple complexes, rather than working themselves to the bone for next to no reward. This process, known as anachoresis, literally to go up country, had occurred quite frequently in pharaonic times of famine, crop failure, or acute economic pressure. This time, however, it was spearheaded by fully trained, battle-hardened troops who had seen how the other half lived in Alexandria. The rebellion soon spread to the Delta, where a vicious 21-year guerrilla war broke out. But if it was bad in the Delta, it was far worse farther up the Nile. Around the old Egyptian city of Thebes, just across the river from the resting places of the greatest native Egyptian pharaohs in the Valley of the Kings, nationalism was rife. Upper Egypt, backed by the kings of Nubia, now effectively seceded from the north, and the rebels declared their leader, an Egyptian named Herwenifer, their pharaoh in 206 BC. Though Ptolemy had retrieved his territories in Syria, he had almost simultaneously lost more than half of Egypt and his lifeblood, her grain. The Nile Valley and the Fayum were the great breadbaskets of Egypt, and with them in rebel hands the Ptolemies and Alexandria's revenues plummeted. So severe was the economic crisis that at one point Ptolemy had to abandon the use of silver coinage and introduce a worthless bronze currency instead. The need to retain a large standing army to oppose the rebels further increased the burden on the economy. Egypt could no longer pay her bills. At the very center of the maelstrom stood the temples. The early Ptolemies had always been extremely careful to cultivate the temple priests, whose institutions not only nominally owned much of the land, but also collected the taxes on behalf of the crown. Traditionally, the temples had also been a way for these foreign pharaohs to demonstrate their credentials for ruling Egypt. As the revolt gained momentum, many of these institutions fell into rebel hands, including the vast new complex begun under Ptolemy III at Edfu, the Temple of Horus. This magnificent building, measuring 448 feet in length and 246 feet in breadth, would become a monument to Philopator's increasingly unsustainable belief that he could live as a Greek Basileus, but rule Egypt as a divine pharaoh. Perhaps the most striking aspect of the temple is how this huge monument, the pylons at the entrance are nearly 130 feet tall, and all its architecture and decoration are executed entirely in the pharaonic tradition. Great bas-relief carvings depict the Greek pharaohs in battle, and specific mythological tales relating to the patron god Horus, the falcon-headed son of Isis and Osiris, are all depicted in traditional fashion. The temple itself was said to be built on the site of the mythic battle between Horus and his deadly enemy Seth, god of chaos and murderer of Osiris. And it was doubtless to Philopator's taste that the great temple was also the scene of a love match. Every year, at the Feast of the Beautiful Meeting, a statue of Horus's wife, Hathor, travelled by river from her temple at Dendera to be brought together with her husband, arriving at the full moon and spending their nights in the Mamissi, or birthing house. Reliefs at the entrance to the Mamissi, some still retaining their coloured paint, portray the ritual of the birth of Harsomptos, Horus and Hathor's son, and symbolically represent the fertility of the gods, their royal descendants, and the nation as a whole. Yet the inscriptions on the temple itself show that from the beginning of the Troubles, no further work was carried out on the building, and therefore, we must assume, no revenues from the temple's estates were returned to Alexandria until long after the king's death. Then trouble arose, because ignorant rebels interrupted in the south the works on the throne of the gods, i.e., the temple of Edfu. The rebellion raged in the south until year 19 of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, the heir of the gods Philopatores, the son of Re, Ptolemy, loved by Ptah, now deceased, the god Epiphanes, the strong one, the king who chased disorder out of the country. Inscription from the Naos. It was ironic that after the outrageous success at Raphia, it would be his own Egyptians, those ignorant rebels who would humble the all-conquering pharaoh and bring his most Egyptian work, the building of the Temple of Horus at Edfu, to a halt. After his victory in Palestine, Ptolemy IV had chosen to return to Egypt on that god's birthday, travelling like the new Horus downstream by ship from Memphis to Alexandria at the inception of the annual flooding and symbolic rebirth of the Nile. To honour him and his sister wife, it was decreed that statues of the king and queen be placed in the largest courts of all the major temples in Egypt. Ptolemy Horus, it was declared, was his father's protector, and his victory at Raphia was beautiful. In this way, the polite fiction of the divinity of Ptolemy Philopator was at least maintained in his own mind. In truth, the victory was not beautiful, but hollow. In 204 BC, still in the midst of the native rebellion and just 40 years old, Philopator departed to join the gods. The circumstances surrounding his death are shrouded in mystery. There was no formal announcement of his death from Sosibius or Agathocles. He simply wasn't seen for several months. Then, mysteriously, his wife's sister Arsinoe, who would certainly have taken the role of regent, disappeared too. Finally, Sosibius summoned the court and announced that both king and queen were dead. He then proceeded to read out a forged royal will, appointing himself and Agathocles guardians of the new king. There were few tears shed for the death of the king, but the people were immediately suspicious about Arsinoe's death. How had she come to die simultaneously with her husband, and what, or who, had killed her. Polybius tells us that on receiving the news of her unhappy death, the people fell into such a state of distraction and affliction that the town was full of groans, tears, and ceaseless lamentation, a testimony, in the opinion of those who judged correctly, not so much of affection for Arsinoe as of hatred for Agathocles. Sosibius escaped the backlash, dying a few months later. But Agathocles was determined to continue as sole guardian of the new king and proxy ruler of the nation. His first acts were to send away from Alexandria all the most able and influential people at court on diplomatic missions, so that he gained absolute ascendancy there. Having secured his own position, he began to revel in it, living a life of constant drunkenness and debauchery, sparing neither women in the flower of their age, nor brides, nor virgins, and all this he did with the most odious ostentation. Loathing of Agathocles had spread throughout the streets of Alexandria, and among the Macedonian soldiers quartered there, and when Agathocles attempted to torture and execute some soldiers he thought were plotting against him, word spread around the garrison and among the townsfolk that revolt was imminent. At the same time, Agathocles was engrossed, as Polybius would have it, in his nightly banquet and orgy, after which he fell into a drunken sleep. He was aroused from this by a party of furious soldiers, demanding that the king be surrendered to them. Realizing that he and his sister were trapped, Agathocles eventually surrendered the boy with his bodyguard to the soldiers, who took him on horseback to the stadium, where crowds of citizens and soldiers had assembled. The crowds were elated to see the king freed, but bayed for the blood of the tyrant Agathocles and his harlot sister. At that moment, Sosibius's son, who had remained in the background since his father's death, saw an opportunity to betray his father's old colleague, and perhaps improve his own standing. Approaching the king, he asked his assent for the crowd to be given satisfaction. The pharaoh apparently nodded, and the crowd roared its approval as soldiers set off to the houses of Agathocles and his sister. In due course they, their attendants, and all their families were brought shackled to the stadium, the women naked, where they were stabbed, bitten, and mutilated until they were all dead. "For terrible is the cruelty of the Egyptians when their anger is aroused," notes Polybius, the histories. The younger Sosibius meanwhile slipped away with the young king, eager to protect him from the sight of the mob at work. Polybius is equally merciless in his final assessment of Agathocles, damning his memory as formidably as the Alexandrians had damned the man. "Agathocles displayed neither courage in war, nor conspicuous ability, nor was he fortunate and exemplary in his management of his affairs, nor, finally, had he that acuteness and mischievous address which serve a courtier's ends, and which made Sosibius and several others so successful until the ends of their lives in their management of king after king. On the contrary, it was quite different with Agathocles. Owing to Philopater's incapacity as a ruler, he attained an exceptionally high position. And in this position, finding himself after the king's death most favourably circumstanced to maintain his power, he lost both his control and his life through his own cowardice and indolence." Polybius, The Histories. The key phrase here, however, is not about Agathocles, it's about Ptolemy IV. "Owing to Philopator's incapacity as a ruler." And there lies the rub. Ptolemy's failings had sadly not died with him. Indeed, his legacy was only just beginning to bear its bitter fruits. Yet from the inscriptions surviving from the early reign of his son, Ptolemy V, one could be forgiven for thinking that another renaissance was in the air. From this date come a number of apparently upbeat reports. The uprising in the Delta was finally brought under control by a ruse. Well protected in the same papyrus marshlands that had harboured the Egyptian resistance to the Persians, the leaders of the revolt had proved impossible to capture, until an offer of a peace was made. When the leaders finally emerged to sign the peace declaration, they were promptly arrested, harnessed to carts, and forced to drag them like animals through the streets. They were then publicly tortured to death. But Ptolemy V proved merciful, if we are to believe one famous, laudatory inscription that dates from this time, the Rosetta Stone, whose fame as a key to translating hieroglyphics has rather overshadowed its actual contents. It deals with the aftermath of the Delta Rebellion, restoring lands and rights, and making concessions, particularly in the temples. When it comes to the rebels themselves, it also treads a cautious but clearly victorious line, saying the king had ordained that those who return of the warrior class and of others who were unfavourably disposed in the days of the disturbances should, on their return, be allowed to occupy their old possessions. The news from Upper Egypt seemed positive as well, if we can rely on the inscriptions at Edfu that marked the restoration of the temple after the rebellion and spoke of the new Ptolemy as the king who chased disorder out of the country. But in these inscriptions rests the lie. Ptolemy V was king in name only. He hadn't chased anyone or anything out of the country, nor had he magnanimously pardoned the rebels. He was just a boy growing up in a court of murderous favourites. On his death, still young, there were no brothers to succeed him, no adult kings in waiting who might take the court in hand and reassert royal power. They had all been killed on Ptolemy V's succession, and the only real achievement of his short life was the siring of a son of his own, another child pharaoh, to take on the mantle of political impotence on his death and continue the cycle of manipulation and murder. While court factions squabbled for control of the boy pharaoh, real political power was slipping away. Few rulers of the Near East believed any pharaoh would last long, and without a real leader in Egypt, they grabbed every opportunity to erode his empire. The descendants of Alexander's other generals, the Seleucids in Persia and Syria, and the kings of Macedonia, took back all of Egypt's territories in the Aegean, Asia Minor, and Palestine, and there was little danger of revenge. But while the court bewailed the loss of empire, and the Alexandrian merchants the loss of trading influence, both would have done well to look across the Mediterranean to a far greater threat looming on the horizon.
Chapter 11. The Last Pharaoh. For Rome, who had never condescended to fear any nation or people, did in her time fear two human beings. One was Hannibal, and the other was a woman. Mary R. Lefkowitz and Maureen B. Fant, Women in Greece and Rome. Three things would bring down the Ptolemaic dynasty and bring to a close the 3-millennia-old rule of the pharaohs. The first was the huge success of the early Ptolemies, whose radical reinvention of the Egyptian state made the nation once again a treasure worth fighting for. The second was the failure of their heirs to resist being seduced by the wealth and power they inherited. The third did not come from within Egypt, but, in the summer of 48 BC, was already travelling across the sea toward Egypt and Alexandria. On the deck of that ship stood the leader of an aggressive Italian people who was writing himself into world history as the greatest general since Alexander. What and whom he found there would set the scene for perhaps the most famous series of romances in history, later immortalized by William Shakespeare. And their results would be no less deadly to all concerned than fate was to Shakespeare's other star-crossed lovers, Romeo and Juliet. Since Alexander's death in 323 BC, the eastern Mediterranean had been involved in an almost continuous struggle among the descendants of his heirs for control of an empire that had always been more myth than reality. But while Macedonians, Seleucids, and Ptolemies fought, another power had been growing in the west which would come to dominate them all: Rome. The warning signs had been there since the First Punic War, when Rome decided to clip the wings of the rival trading empire of Carthage. Archimedes had actually seen it in the eyes of the Roman soldiers besieging his city of Syracuse, and felt it in his last moments on the point of a Roman sword. Rome was not a state to countenance other empires when it had in its power to bring them down. Carthage had come back for more, keen to stand up to the cold, unblinking expansionism of Rome, and had been defeated again. Finally, after the Third Punic War, Carthage was not only defeated, but erased from the face of the earth. The Roman orator Cato had first found expression for what was clearly now Rome's policy when he exhorted the Senate with the words, "Carthago delenda est." Carthage must be destroyed. And it was. The city of Carthage itself was demolished, its inhabitants were massacred, and the fields around it were, according to legend, sown with salt, so nothing and no one could live there. There could be no clearer statement of the Romans' overall intent. They would never be content with being players in the game of ruling the Mediterranean world. They planned to be the victors. That their attention would turn to Alexandria was inevitable. Between the death of Ptolemy IV and the accession of Ptolemy IX, the Roman state had patiently watched 150 years of Egyptian economic decline. Rome had no need to humble Egypt as it had Carthage. Egypt was doing that on her own. When most of the work of conquest had been done, Rome finally chose to act, drawn to the Alexandrian flame by Egypt's two remaining treasures, her potential to grow grain and the greatest library and museum in the world. If it was grain that actually brought the Romans to Alexandria, that was not its only attraction for her generals. Despite their republican protestations, it was clear that some of the military leaders of the late Republic, men like Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, craved a place in history alongside that greatest conqueror of them all, Alexander. To them, the journey to Alexandria was as much pilgrimage as diplomatic mission, even if the tomb of Alexander himself was now closed, supposedly to protect the bodies of the Ptolemaic pharaohs who now rested alongside him. In truth, as the Romans probably well knew, it was to disguise the fact that the bankrupt Ptolemy IV had pawned Alexander's golden coffin. But Alexandria held one other attraction for the men of this new world power. By the great harbour, in a palace flanked with ancient obelisks, a new pharaoh ruled. She would be Egypt's last, and perhaps the most famous, Cleopatra. The reign of Cleopatra will always be remembered for drawing the curtain on the Ptolemaic world, but in truth, by the time she ascended to the throne in 51 BC, Egypt was already lost. As far back as 80 BC, her father, Ptolemy XII, had been little more than a puppet of the Roman dictator Sulla, having formally allied himself with Rome. Egypt's ancient name had then been inscribed on the Roman list of allies and friends, the Amici et Socii Populi Romani, which proved to be the death warrant of so many independent states. Roman friendships were very one-way affairs, and despite Egypt's paying a sizable tribute for the privilege of friendship, this formal alliance had not prevented Rome from seizing those Egyptian possessions it felt it needed, including the island of Cyprus, which had been ruled by Ptolemy's brother. For his part, Ptolemy, already overawed by this new world power, sat quietly by and watched until the people of Alexandria, incensed at his inaction, forced him to flee to his friends in Rome. Eventually, the Romans reinstalled him in Egypt, their friendship extending at least to him personally. But he would enjoy his kingdom for only another 4 years. In his will, he left his country to his daughter Cleopatra and her brother and husband, the 10-year-old Ptolemy XIII. Tellingly, he chose as his executor the people of Rome. And so, in the spring of 51 BC, a succession of grossly corrupt and weak rulers, whose lives were defined by little more than assassinations and revolts, reached its end, and one last Ptolemy rose to the throne of Egypt. In Cleopatra, however, a free Egypt and a free Alexandria had one final flourish. Cleopatra was the most remarkable Ptolemy for many generations. Crowned pharaoh while still a teenager, she was the antithesis of the gross caricature that later Romans would draw of her. For many of them, she was a convenient excuse for the bloody civil wars that led to the collapse of their beloved republic and the instigation of totalitarian imperial rule. She was cast as the lascivious temptress, an untrustworthy Eastern woman intent on polluting the moral virtue of Rome and its generals. It was a classic piece of Roman propaganda, and one so successful that it still dogs her memory to this day. The truth was very different. Cleopatra had been born in Alexandria, and, unlike so many of her predecessors, had clearly revelled in the intellectual life that still thrived in what were her dynasty's greatest achievements, the library and museum. As a child, she had shown an aptitude for languages, learning Greek, Aramaic, Latin, Ethiopic, and Hebrew, all the main languages of the library, as well as being the first and last Ptolemaic pharaoh ever to learn the native tongue of the country she ruled, Egyptian. She was not, if her coin portraits are to be more trusted than Roman propaganda, the great beauty that later romances and films have made her. But that is perhaps to pay her a compliment. She was no two-dimensional Helen, and her personal magnetism, which even Roman sources are forced to admit, came from a mind and personality moulded in what was still the intellectual capital of the world. In fact, even the pro-Roman historian Plutarch concedes that she was much more than simply a beauty. For her beauty, as we are told, was in itself not altogether incomparable, nor such as to strike those who saw her. But converse with her had an irresistible charm, and her presence, combined with the persuasiveness of her discourse, and the character which was somehow diffused about her behaviour towards others, had something stimulating about it. There was sweetness also in the tones of her voice, and her tongue, like an instrument of many strings, she could readily turn to whatever language she pleased. Plutarch, Life of Antony. It was this that marked her out from so many previous Ptolemaic also-rans. Plutarch had no desire to eulogize Cleopatra, but even he could not help but record that her strength came not from her looks, but from her mind. It would be another 1,550 years before the English philosopher Sir Francis Bacon would coin the dictum, "Knowledge is power." But already in Caesar's day, Cleopatra was proving it. Sadly, this alone would not be enough to stop Rome from interfering in her rule. Rome chose the stages on which it played out its story, and when it chose wealthy and desirable Egypt, Cleopatra and her people had little choice but to join in the drama. The end game of pharaonic Egypt was played out against the backdrop of the bloody struggles among Rome's most powerful generals. In 49 BC, when Julius Caesar's power-sharing arrangement with his ally Pompey collapsed, the seeds of Roman civil war were sown, and Egypt, feeling forced to back one side or the other, had provided ships, grain, and money for Pompey's cause. It proved a mistake, and now, following his defeat at the Battle of Pharsalus, the news came that Pompey was fleeing to Egypt. The timing could not have been worse, for there was no peace in Egypt either at that time. Indeed, Cleopatra was at war with her brother. A more typical later Ptolemy by far, the young Ptolemy XIII was still under the thrall of three of his ministers, the eunuch Pothinus, Theodotus of Cos, his teacher of rhetoric, and the Egyptian Achillas. These three men had precipitated a split between the co-regents, and Cleopatra had been expelled from Alexandria. Ptolemy was now camped at Pelusium with his army, ready to bring his co-regency and his sister's life to a bloody end, when news of Pompey's arrival reached him. It was an invidious situation for any monarch. With Pompey in Egypt, Julius Caesar could not be far behind. If the pharaoh protected the one, he would become the other's enemy, and in either case he would be an enemy of Rome. And so, according to Plutarch, he, or rather his advisers, took a gamble. With Pompey's trireme riding at anchor off the treacherous shore, Achillas was sent out in a rowboat to bring the Roman over the shoals to shore and into the presence of the king. Pompey himself was nervous, fearing a trap, but powerless to resist. As Achillas rowed up, he held out a hand to help Pompey into the little tender. The general turned to his wife and son and embraced them, quoting a line of Sophocles, "He that once enters at a tyrant's door becomes a slave, though he were free before." Plutarch, Life of Pompey. He then climbed on board and was rowed silently toward the beach. It was a long row, and during the trip he took out the speech he had prepared for the king and read it through. Then as the boat grounded and he was being helped to his feet, his assassins struck and he was repeatedly stabbed. To the accompaniment of his wife's screams carrying from the far-off trireme, his head was hacked off, and his body unceremoniously dumped in the sea. It was a bloody murder, but of a type in which both the Egyptians and Romans occasionally indulged in the name of politics. His head was taken to Ptolemy, who, when Caesar's fleet arrived off Alexandria just 2 days later, sent a messenger with the gruesome gift. But if Ptolemy thought that assassinating Caesar's enemy would make him Caesar's friend, or that it would encourage the Romans to fight their civil wars elsewhere, he had seriously misunderstood Roman politics. In fact, he had provided Caesar with the perfect excuse. Had Caesar ordered Pompey killed, he would have alienated at least a part of his own people. Now he could portray Pompey as a man whom he had disagreed with, but a fellow Roman all the same. It had been the treacherous and untrustworthy Egyptians who had killed him, all the more reason to interfere in and perhaps annex their country. Plutarch describes, without a hint of irony, the moment when Caesar received Pompey's head, and the crocodile tears began to flow. From the man who brought him Pompey's head, he turned away with loathing, as from an assassin. And on receiving Pompey's seal ring, he burst into tears. Caesar could now play the avenging Roman angel, while conveniently ignoring the fact that it had been he who had driven Pompey to his death. Instead of taking the war away from Egypt, as Ptolemy had hoped, Caesar ordered his troops to land and occupy Alexandria. Caesar quickly sent for reinforcements and meanwhile set up his headquarters in the royal palace and did his best to look like a peaceful visitor. According to Lucan, he admired the sights of the city, including the tomb of Alexander. And according to Appian, he even joined the crowds listening to the public to play the peacemaker between the claimants to the throne, Ptolemy XIII and Cleopatra, whom he asked to appear before him. For Cleopatra it was a risk. Her forces were not in control of Alexandria or Egypt, and she did not have the support of the Alexandrians, or perhaps many Egyptians. Nor could she know what deal, if any, her treacherous brother had struck with the Roman. Her only hope was to use her skills to influence Caesar in private, so she got word to him asking for a secret audience. Smuggled back into the city under a coverlet, or rolled in a carpet in some versions of the tale, she found herself in the presence of the most powerful man on earth. He was 52 years old. She was not yet 22. But in a single night she persuaded him to make her queen again. Lucan, in his Pharsalia, reveling in his own imaginings of that evening, describes how. There in her fatal beauty lay the queen, thick daubed with unguents, nor with throne content, nor with her brother spouse. Laden she lay, on neck and hair with all the Red Sea spoils, and faint beneath the weight of gems and gold. Her snowy breast shone through Sidonian lawn, which woven close by shuttles of the east, the art of Nile had loosened. Lucan, Pharsalia. It was the beginning of the greatest love story in antiquity, but the beginning of the end for a free Alexandria and a free Egypt. Cleopatra had seen which way the wind was blowing, and during that night she successfully distanced herself from both Pompey and her brother, the co-regent, so that he would take the full blame for Egypt's ill-considered interference in a Roman civil war. With the deadly calculation and lack of filial love that the Ptolemies were famed for, she now appealed to an unassailable Julius Caesar to reinstall her as pharaoh alongside her truculent brother. The next day, Ptolemy XIII arrived in the palace to find Cleopatra at Caesar's side. In an act almost certainly orchestrated by his adviser, Pothenos, he then cried out that he was betrayed and ran from the palace, tearing the crown from his head. It was a brilliant move. The people of Alexandria immediately swarmed to the man who appeared to be holding out against Roman occupation and threatened to storm the palace. Caesar managed on this occasion to calm the Alexandrians, reading Ptolemy XII's will to them and giving his guarantee that it would be fulfilled, i.e., that Ptolemy XIII and Cleopatra would rule. But he decided to take the young Ptolemy XIII into protective custody, just in case. The scene was now set for the Alexandrine War, a war which would witness the partial destruction of the thing the Ptolemies held most dear, their library. Caesar had miscalculated. In purely military terms, it made a lot more sense to support Ptolemy XIII and his advisers, who still had a sizable army and the support of many in Alexandria. But one night with Cleopatra had changed his mind. Her wit, charm and political brilliance, the assets of an Alexandrian scholar, had put him in her thrall, and he would pay a high price for it. But while an enchanted Caesar promised the return of Cyprus to Egypt's control, and the rebuilding of Cleopatra's power base, he had more immediate problems closer to home. Pothenos had summoned the royal army to besiege Caesar in Alexandria, knowing him to have come to Egypt with only a small force. Unable to field his inferior army in open battle, Caesar was forced to watch from the palace walls as most of Alexandria fell under Pothenos's control, and its people, including slaves, were formed into armed militias in protest against what looked to them like Roman military rule. Caesar had called for reinforcements, but these would take time to arrive. In the meantime, he was forced to look for a stronghold that might at least give him control of the great harbour. His sights fell on Pharos, and he left us with one of the few eyewitness descriptions of this wonder of the world. The Pharos is a tower on an island of prodigious height, built with amazing works, and takes its name from the island. This island lying over against Alexandria forms a harbour. But on the upper side it is connected with the town by a narrow way 800 paces in length, made by piles sunk in the sea, and by a bridge. In this island some of the Egyptians have houses, and a village as large as a town. Julius Caesar. Caesar's interest in the island was purely practical. Even in his day the island of Pharos was still famous for the pirates who would set upon any ship that accidentally ran aground there, or failed to make the harbour entrance. This told him everything he needed to know. As he always did, Caesar reported himself in the third party. Without the consent of those who are masters of the Pharos, no vessels can enter the harbour on account of its narrowness. Caesar, being greatly alarmed on this account, while the enemy were engaged in battle, landed his soldiers, seized the Pharos, and placed a garrison in it. Julius Caesar, Commentary on the Gallic and Civil Wars. Whatever Caesar now chose to do, Cleopatra could do little but support him. In a way, the people of the city militias were right. It did look like a Roman occupation, with her as puppet, and in truth, when reinforcements arrived, Caesar might simply have seized Alexandria and made it his. Cleopatra had made her choice, but as Roman troops swarmed over Pharos, she was about to discover its true cost. The ships remaining in the harbour were an obvious danger for Caesar, and he didn't have to think twice about what to do. He tells us, in his own words, "The enemy endeavoured to seize with a strong party the ships of war. They were all of either 3 or 5 banks of oars, well equipped and appointed with every necessity for a voyage. Besides these, there were 22 vessels with decks, which were usually kept at Alexandria, to guard the port. If they made themselves masters of these, Caesar being deprived of his fleet, they would have the command of the port and whole sea, and could prevent him from procuring provisions and auxiliaries. But Caesar gained the day and set fire to all those ships and to others which were in the docks." Julius Caesar, Commentary on the Gallic and Civil Wars. It was summer, and the famed Etesian wind was blowing from the north. Normally this brought cool relief to the people of Alexandria, but now, as the ships erupted in flames, burning canvas and rope spiraled into the sky and were blown across the city. First, the warehouses on the wharves caught alight, then the dockyards themselves. At this point, Plutarch tells us, in a single, bald sentence, "This spread from the dockyards and destroyed the great library." There is some confusion among the sources as to whether the great library in the royal quarter itself caught fire, or just the book warehouses on the waterfront, which housed volumes for export and those impounded from the ships. The lack of explicit references to the great library after this date might suggest that this fire was considerably more than a warehouse blaze. It was a disaster. By the time the fire was out, one source reports, some 400,000 papyrus scrolls had been lost. It was not the end of Alexandria's library, but the great library itself would never recover its former importance, and the second, or daughter, library at the Serapeum would now begin to supplant it. The days of Eratosthenes and Archimedes, of Euclid and Callimachus, had passed, and as Cleopatra surveyed the burning city, the works that her ancestors had invested their lives in fluttered in burned ribbons about her. This was the price of Caesar's support. Indeed, some claim the fire in the library was started deliberately on his orders. The library was the Ptolemaic jewel, the last great treasure Rome could not own without first conquering Egypt. Knowledge was Alexandria's strength, and perhaps that made it dangerous in the eyes of the Roman state. But knowledge was as vulnerable and ephemeral as the papyrus on which it was written. What had taken a lifetime to learn, Caesar could destroy in a morning with little more than a torch. The navy could be rebuilt, the houses repaired, but the books in the library could not so easily be replaced. No records survive to tell us what books were lost that day. But if the damage was extensive, it was at least not total, and Alexandria remained a library city. Of those lost, some could be recopied from other sources, and other copies could be bought. But in an age when a book might exist in only a handful of handwritten copies, some of the great works of antiquity may have died forever that day. It had been just a shot across the bow, but the sight of smoke rising over the library, or even just the book warehouses, marked a change in the life of the library and prefigured its final demise. The library, for all its learning, was vulnerable, and increasingly would now be seen not only as an asset, but as a liability. The pen was perhaps still mightier than the sword, but without soldiers to protect it, the single barracks where those words were stored was little more than a tinderbox awaiting a casual spark. With the burning of the library, one era was coming to an end, but on the streets a new one had yet to materialize. The library was certainly the most important casualty in the Alexandrian War, but that war was not yet over, and there was a danger that Caesar might also succumb. At one point he was reportedly set upon when his own ship was stormed by hostile Alexandrians, and, despite his years, had to dive into the harbour and swim for the safety of ships moored farther out. Ptolemy's men were now also pumping salt water into the palace's elaborate water system in an attempt to contaminate the water supply, a very early form of chemical warfare. It was a dangerous game of brinkmanship. Would Caesar and Cleopatra succumb, or would Roman reinforcements arrive? In a last-ditch effort to stall for time, Caesar finally released the hostage Ptolemy XIII, but much to his disappointment, this seems only to have intensified the fighting. Fortunately for Caesar, Roman political and military might was about to force events. Mithridates of Pergamum, Caesar's general, was now just outside Pelusium, with Cleopatra's own troops and contingents from Judea and Nabatea. Caesar rushed to join them, and in the ensuing battle Ptolemy XIII lost his life, apparently drowned in the Nile. When Caesar returned to Alexandria, he was the victor, and the unhappy but pragmatic Alexandrians could do nothing but bow to him and the ruler they had tried to shun, Cleopatra. When Caesar left Egypt, he ordered 3 legions to stay in the country for the protection of the queen, who was now carrying his son, Caesarion, son of Caesar, as the Alexandrians called him. Of course, few in Alexandria can have doubted that this was not so much an army of protection as one of occupation. With her on the throne, he had placed the child king Ptolemy XIV, her younger brother and new husband, as a concession to the supporters of Ptolemy XIII. No one doubted, however, who was in control. Egypt was now, in essence, a Roman protectorate, but while the queen's relationship with Caesar remained close, Egypt was safe and flourished. A year later, Cleopatra was in Rome with her baby son and her co-ruler. The city was not yet perhaps the city of marble that the Emperor Augustus so proudly boasted of, if we believe his own propaganda, but still the city of brick which he would inherit from Caesar. It was also a city of rumour. Cleopatra's influence on Caesar was said to be growing, and was causing much distrust in Rome. For her visit, she was staying in Caesar's own house, a scandal in itself, for while what had happened in Egypt was, as the historian and Roman senator Cassius Dio points out, only hearsay, their behaviour in Rome was clear for all to see. For many Romans this proved that the great Caesar's head had been turned by a mere girl. They commented that the Alexandrian War, unlike his other victories, was an unnecessary diversion, and one he undertook not for the glory of Rome, but out of his love for Cleopatra. There were also in the city those who feared her son would be the heir to Rome, as Caesar had had no children by his wife, Calpurnia, whom he had divorced in 53 BC. And there were other signs that his time in Alexandria had influenced him. During Cleopatra's visit, Caesar introduced the new and more accurate Julian calendar to Rome, which had until that date calculated its years based on a lunar reckoning. This had led, as Cassius Dio puts it, to the days getting somewhat out of order. This new, improved calendar had a 365-day year divided into 12 months, with one extra day added every fourth leap year. This exceptionally precise calendar, accurate to one day in 1,461 years, was not, of course, invented by Caesar, but a product of the mind of Eratosthenes, devised and refined in the Museum of Alexandria. Cleopatra was also having a more direct influence on her lover,
playing the game of power politics just as well as he could. On her return to Alexandria, her co-ruler was conveniently murdered, so she could now rule jointly with Caesarion. Caesar could content himself with the knowledge that his only son was already a pharaoh, while Cleopatra, sharing a throne with her baby, knew she could, in effect, rule alone. Despite her political intriguing, however, events were moving too fast even for Cleopatra. Little did she know that when she left Rome, she would never see her lover again. The mood in the Roman Senate had been turned against Caesar for some time, and the appearance in Rome of his eastern mistress had done little to improve his standing. Many feared that with Cleopatra's financial aid, he would soon dismantle the Republic and install himself over them as tyrant. So on the Ides of March, 44 BC, a small group of senatorial conspirators ensured it would never come to pass. Julius Caesar was assassinated in Pompey's Theatre in Rome, and Cleopatra was once again alone. That year the Nile floods failed, and there was famine in Egypt. The man to whom she now turned for support would prove to be her last ally, and one whose relationship with her has gone down in history as one of the greatest and most tragic romances of all time. Cleopatra was a practical Alexandrian and knew she needed to pick a winner from the civil war into which Rome was diving headlong. There was now a choice of three. Octavian, Julius Caesar's personal heir and effective ruler of the west of the empire, Lepidus, in command in Africa, or Mark Antony, in the east. All three triumvirs theoretically ruled together. But the time was coming when everyone would have to choose. But in choosing Mark Antony, Cleopatra made more than a simple political decision. Mark Antony was a natural soldier, with a fine physique and an iron constitution that excesses and hardships alike failed to weaken. His courage, affability, and generosity made him hugely popular with his men, and when he invited Cleopatra to Tarsus in 41 BC, even the Queen of Egypt could hardly refuse the man who had hunted down and defeated Caesar's murderers. He was clearly the logical, as well as the emotional heir to Cleopatra's affections, and in his presence she once again turned around her cities and her country's fortunes in a single night. She arrived in Tarsus, displaying all the magnificence and sophistication of an Alexandrian monarch. She was Isis and Aphrodite, the perfect refinement of a Hellenistic ruler and a woman at the height of her powers. Plutarch, in his Life of Antony, describes her arrival, "In a barge with gilded poop, its sails spread purple, its rowers urging it on with silver oars to the sound of the flute, blended with pipes and lutes. She herself reclined beneath a canopy spangled with gold, adorned like Venus in a painting, while boys like loves in paintings stood on either side and fanned her. Likewise also the fairest of her serving maidens, attired like nereids and graces, were stationed some at the rudder sweeps and others at the reefing ropes. Wondrous odours from countless incense offerings diffused themselves along the river banks." Plutarch, Life of Antony, in Parallel Lives. After that arrival, the meeting could be nothing other than a success. The first night she banqueted him, the second he tried to respond but was forced to admit his efforts were rustic compared with the magnificence of her meal. But regardless of the food, the bond between them was already fast. After this brief first meeting, Antony returned the compliment by spending the whole of the following winter with her in Alexandria. For a moment it seemed that together they could do more than save Egypt. For a wonderful, willfully blind moment it seemed they could inherit Alexander's dream. The Alexandrians loved Antony, saying he wore a tragic face for the Romans but a comic mask with them. The two lovers spent days in gilded games, most famously a fishing trip, which Plutarch also describes. Having gone fishing with Cleopatra, Antony was embarrassed at his lack of luck, and quietly asked one of his fishermen to dive below the boat and attach to the line a fish they had caught earlier. The trick seemed to work, and Cleopatra appeared impressed by the sudden haul which followed. She was no fool, however, and had noticed. The next day she gathered large numbers of courtiers together for another fishing trip, so they might witness Antony's prowess. When he dropped his line overboard, she signalled to her fisherman, who dived down and attached a salted herring to his line. When he pulled it in, there was great laughter, and the queen turned to her champion, saying, Imperator, hand over thy fishing rod to the fishermen of Pharos and Canopus. Thy sport is the hunting of cities, realms, and continents. Then there were the love tokens. He gave Egypt back its foreign territories in Asia Minor, and in return she directed the vast wealth of Egypt to his ambition. The following summer, as if to seal the deal, she bore him twins, Alexander Helios, the sun, and Cleopatra Selene, the moon. In return he gave her the one present every Ptolemy coveted. The wealthy kingdom of Pergamum, in what is today Turkey, had recently been acquired by the Roman state, having rather unusually been left to Rome in the will of its last king. For the Romans it was a rich trading nation and a welcome source of revenue, but for any Alexandrian it held something worth more than gold. A library of some 200,000 volumes, the second largest collection of books on earth. This was Antony's gift to Cleopatra, a suitable recompense for Caesar's damage to the great library and an investment in its future. It was the greatest gift an Alexandrian could receive. But the heirs of Julius Caesar had no desire to see another Alexander arise in Egypt, and what was more, their leader, Octavian, had personal reasons to distrust Mark Antony, who was still, at least in name, married to his sister. Now Antony was, in Octavian's view, under the control of that evil eastern temptress who had ruined Julius Caesar. She was everything Rome stood against, a foreigner, a competitor, a political player, and, perhaps worst of all, a woman in an era when Rome viewed women as simply their father's or husband's possessions. Despite several reconciliations, it was clear that Octavian's desire to rule Rome and Mark Antony's dreams of an empire in the east were set to clash head-on. In the end, driven on by Cleopatra, Antony abandoned his wife, in the process snubbing Octavian, and returned to Alexandria to plan one final bid for glory. Together they fueled a propaganda campaign to have themselves associated with Dionysus and Aphrodite, or for their Egyptian subjects, Osiris and Isis. They were to be living gods destined to rule over a new Alexandrian empire. He would provide the military might, she the money, and together they would achieve Alexander's dream and rule an eastern empire from the city he had founded for that purpose. So enchanted with the prospect was Cleopatra that she instigated a new system for counting dates. This would now be the year one. In 36 BC, however, that dream began to crumble. An overconfident Antony suffered a crushing defeat on his expedition against Parthia, leading many of his senior military commanders to doubt both his judgment and his motives. These were Roman troops, after all, and though they had followed Antony across the Middle East, they had done so in the name of Rome, not Alexandria. Many were also aware that his rivalry with Octavian was now beyond reconciliation. Caesar's adopted heir was no fool, and clearly saw in Mark Antony's expeditions a personal ambition that far outstripped the orders he received from Rome. He also saw behind him a son of Cleopatra's, Caesarion, a true heir to Julius Caesar.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.